Future Proof Extra from News Talk.
Did you know that 90% of statistics are made up? No? Well, that's good because it's not true. Benjamin Disraeli famously said there are three kinds of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics. Except he didn't say that either. It's not true. It's really difficult to figure out what's right and what's not right in the world of fake news. And we add statistics and numbers into the mix, it only gets more murky. So Paul Goodwin, emeritus professor at the University of Bath and author of Something Doesn't Add Up, Surviving Statistics in a Post-Truth World, is possibly someone who might be able to help us with that. Paul, welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
Tell me about the book.
Well, I can add another quote to the one that you've come up with. Over a century ago, the Scottish poet Andrew Lang allegedly said that people use statistics in the same way that a drunk uses a lamppost. Now, I can think of several ways a drunk might use a lamppost, but he said more for support than illumination. And I think that we very often already have reached conclusions. So we go to the statistics to prop up our bogus argument rather than genuinely going there objectively to seek illumination. Now, since he made that statement, at least allegedly, the role of statistics in our lives has increased enormously. There are statistics of these days of national happiness, the livability of cities, quality of universities. We now have a phenomenon called datafication, which involves transforming all our lives into data. I had an awful night's sleep last night, but my activity tracker gave me a sleep score of 80. How we shop, exercise, communicate with friends, even our personalities, even our sex lives, dare I say, how we sit in a car, all of these can be represented by numbers. Now, don't get me wrong, statistics used correctly can be terribly powerful, and there are many examples of those in the book. But I think some of these applications are rather dubious, and I wanted to draw attention to these in the book.
Yeah, whenever I see Dublin hailed as the happiest place in the world to live, I mean, the skepticism of journalism, even aside, it just sounds like a stupid thing to say. And how on earth you gather the complex intricacies of people's internal thoughts and then somehow transpose that to a figure that is supposed to make sense is just, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, yes, I mean, take a related thing. The United Nations World Happiness Report, it ranks countries according to their apparent level of happiness. So in 2019, Finland came top with a score of 7.769. Ireland, by the way, was 16th with 7.021. Just behind the UK, we're 0.033 better, more happier than you, apparently. UK scored 7.054. Now, can you really measure the accuracy of an entire country's happiness to three decimal places? I very much doubt it.
So, I mean, before we get into the mathematical fallacies that we see all around us, which I find me grinding my teeth and spitting out nails on the internet late into the morning, why do we see so many of these statistics popping out from reputable organizations and being spread all over the world like they are bona fide fact?
Yes, I think you're right to discriminate between reputable organisations who probably quite often innocently come out with figures which are meaningless, and of course deliberate distortion by politicians who we perhaps won't mention. I think we have an urge for simplicity, and single numbers meet that need for simple answers to problems. For example, league tables, university league tables, again, the quality of universities are often measured to two decimal places. They give us a warm feeling if our alma mater is near the top. And if we're choosing a university to study at, they save us the burden of doing a lot of research about that university. They automatically tell us how good it is and whether it's worth studying there.
Yeah.
But there are huge, huge problems with these league tables. But I think we like nice, neat solutions, single numbers, simple answers. They save us a lot of effort.
Yeah. And I know people in the universities care about how they're ranked because it's a global metric system. The politicians read it, the parents read it, and the people who fund their departments read it. And
Absolutely.
So these ridiculous numbers attribute some sort of sense of worth upon a university that is completely pointless. But then you start to wonder, is anything useful? Let's talk about statistical significance.
Yes.
I know everyone's going, yes, this is exactly what I want to do on a Saturday afternoon. Let's roll up my sleeves and get involved in statistical significance. But it is really important for people to understand even just this one idea, because we hear about it, particularly now in the midst of COVID season, as I'm calling it. We hear it all the time that something is statistically significant.
Yes.
What does that mean? And can we ever really trust that phrase?
Well, first of all, I think the word significance is misplaced. Significant means important, and often you can find out things which are statistically significant, but by no means important. But let me try and explain with an example. Let's imagine that you claim to be able to read my mind. For all I know, you may be able to. So you and I agreed to conduct an experiment to test this, and you're going to be locked in a room, and at prearranged times, I'll select a card from a pack, and you have to write down which card you think I've selected.
Yes.
And we repeat this 10 times. You correctly identify 7 of those 10 cards. Now, were you merely guessing? Well, I do some probability calculations, we'll imagine, and I work out the probability of you getting at least 7 correct by pure guesswork. In other words, you haven't got the special power of reading my mind, was 30%. Well, and most of us would say, well, there's a 30% chance that he could get this level of success by pure guesswork. That's not strong evidence for him having these powers to read my mind. Supposing instead the probability of you getting 7 out of 10 correct is 1 in a million. Well, that looks like pretty strong evidence for your power. Very unlikely you'd get that level of success if you're merely guessing. So how low does the probability have to go before we say, well, we're starting to believe this guy has got this magical power of reading minds? Well, the answer is, in much of science, the arbitrary figure of 5% is used, or 1 in 20. As soon as the probability of getting a set of results is below 1 in 20, we say it's statistically significant. 1 in 20, we say, is beyond the likelihood of chance. Purely an arbitrary figure, the famous statistician R.A. Fisher recommended it simply because it was a convenient number. Yet once the probability gets below this magic figure in scientific papers, it suddenly becomes statistically significant, beyond the likelihood of chance, and we suddenly feel able to claim we've found something important.
And when we're talking about things like medical therapies, their efficacy against things like cancer, or the chance that a new type of material, element, or particle is discovered, I mean, these are important things, and 1 in 20 does not seem remotely accurate enough to be able to publish a paper saying this has been discovered. In astronomy, they don't. In astronomy, they have a sigma system that goes well beyond the idea of 1 in 20. But in medicine, we do see that 5% statistically significant figure being used as a metric.
We do, areas, particularly in testing of drugs, and psychologists use it a lot as well. But I agree with you, it's an arbitrary figure, and 1 in 20 doesn't seem that unlikely to me. So it is very strange that much of science, as many scientific discoveries, bogus or otherwise, have depended on this number. What you should do, of course, if you're writing a paper, is quote the true probability of getting those results if your hypothesis is true. Merely saying it's significant or not significant, if it's either side of that boundary, really can be can really mislead people, I think.
And again, not to hammer home the importance of this, but major health policies, major funding of drugs, major developments of cities have been based on these statistically significant numbers that, as you say, often are used to prop up an argument rather than illuminate. I was listening recently and they were talking about the average age of people who had died from COVID. And there is a problem with these. Some are using median, which I think is probably better. Can you take us through the difference between all of these words and why average can sometimes be completely useless for us to understand anything at all?
Yes, well, averages don't tell you about variation. I mean, the famous author Nassim Taleb reminds us that a tall person can drown crossing a river that's got an average depth of 4 feet, because of course in parts of the river might be 30 feet deep. But there's the old joke you may have heard that if you sit in the kitchen and put 1 foot in the oven and 1 foot in the freezer, on average you're comfortable. I must try it sometime. So they don't tell us about variation. You can live in Finland, allegedly the happiest country in the world, and be very unhappy, of course. And the other problem is that the word average is an umbrella term for several different measures. And you can always pick the one that supports your argument. And the three measures are the mean. That's the one that most people know, where you add up all the numbers and then divide by the number of figures that you've got. That's a well-known average. There's the median. Now, the median, let's imagine I want to find the median height of people in a room. I'd get them all to stand along the wall, from the shortest person, the next shortest, all the way to the tallest person. The height of the person who's in the middle, their height would be the median height. So I could legitimately say that's the average height. And then there's the mode. The mode is the most frequently occurring number. So if I had the numbers 1, 2, 2, 2, 2, 5, 6, the mode is 2, because that occurred most commonly.
Yeah.
And I can legitimately say the average of those numbers is 2. If I'm in a bargaining situation, let's say for more pay, I'd quote the average, which gave me the lowest average wage in my company. If I was the manager, I'd pick the average, which gave the highest average wage. So these things go on. So the word average is a bit of an umbrella term for many different measures.
Yeah, and you see politicians talking about, you know, average earnings. We had our own Taoiseach Leo Varadkar get drummed over this recently by talking about the average earning, which of course includes the real outlier of the 3 or 4 billionaires that we have in the country, which would really skew that idea of an average. There's also the problem with correlation and causation. And I don't know if you saw this paper about the BCG jab, which is a vaccination that many people in Ireland received. There was a correlation between people who received that and getting lighter, less serious symptoms of COVID. And that is very exciting. But again, correlation and causation are two very different things. Saying that because you have the BCG, you're definitely less likely to have a lighter version of COVID is not something we can say yet, because we don't have the data. But we can say there's a correlation with those two things. What's the difference?
Well, you can have lots of fun with correlation and causation. I mean, there's a whole website in America devoted to these spurious correlations. For example, consumption of margarine in Maine, USA, is closely correlated with the state's divorce rate. So if there's a causal link there, they should ban sales of margarine, and that would lead to happier marriages. There are probably three reasons why you can get a correlation, two things going up and down together, when there's no causal link between them. One of the most common ones is there's a hidden third factor. For example, I used to tell my students that I was going to campaign to ban ice cream sales, and they'd look astonished. I'd say, well, ice cream sales are correlated with deaths through drowning. High correlation there. But of course, there's no direct correlation. They're both related to the weather. In warm weather, people buy ice cream. In warm weather, people jump into lakes and into the sea, and unfortunately, so often go into difficulty. Then there are occasions where things just increase together. For example, since the Second World War, the population of Brazil has increased, and the cost of travelling by train in Britain and presumably Ireland has increased as well. But it doesn't mean I can blame the Brazilians when I find my cost of travelling by rail has gone up yet again. They just happen to have gone up together. And then, of course, a sheer coincidence. Some things just happen to be correlated purely by coincidence. So correlation is no evidence or irrefutable evidence of causation. It's a very important thing that you've raised.
There's a number of cases out there, and I think you go into some of them in the book, where knowing how the system is flawed, you can actually game it to your advantage. You were talking about politicians there, but you also mentioned, I don't know what the airport was, where there were baggage handlers.
Yes, but this is the widespread use of proxy measures. When we can't measure something directly, we measure something that we hope is correlated with it, something that's related to it. So, for example, in academia, they often measure the number of papers somebody's published and hope that's a measure of the importance of the research that the person has conducted. The trouble is, as you say, these things can be gamed. There's a famous case, I think the one you're referring to, at an airport where they wanted to improve the time to transfer the baggage from the planes to the carousel. And they decided to measure the time it took the first bag to get from the plane to the carousel. Well, of course, the baggage handlers soon realized what they could do. They picked the fittest, youngest member of their team, found this, the lightest bag, and got them to sprint to the terminal with that bag. And then, of course, sat back, having a chat about the weather, presumably for another 10 minutes before they started unloading the other bags. This is the problem with proxy measures. Once they become a target, they cease to be a decent measure at all.
I kind of hinted that these statistics, interpreting them and how people wield them has an enormous effect on how we live our lives. And that can even go into rather extreme cases where statistics should have been looked at to perhaps save lives. You mentioned the case of Harold Shipman.
Yes, indeed. In the book, I'm not totally negative about the use of statistics, and I talk about examples where statistics should be taken seriously and should be taken notice of. And of course, the case of Harold Shipman, he was most of your listeners will know, he was a GP operating near Manchester in England, very respectable GP. He appeared even on a Granada television documentary, I think. And it turned out, unbelievably at the time, that he was killing his patients. Hundreds of his patients were dying. But of course, hindsight's a wonderful thing. But looking back, no statistics were kept about the death rates of different medical practices. Now, had those records been kept, it would have been pretty obvious that Shipman's death rate was totally a total outlier compared to other ones, and questions would have been asked much earlier. But of course, at the time, it just seemed implausible that a doctor would be behaving that way, and nobody thought to keep these records. Nowadays they do, so anybody who tries to emulate Shipman, I think, will be caught pretty quickly. But hundreds of lives could have been saved if records of his number of deaths had been kept.
At the end of the book, Paul, you have this part where you sort of say, look, if you're looking at statistic, here are the things you need to consider. We might finish up by you arming our listeners with the ability to scrutinize these figures that are thrown at them every single day in their newspapers.
Here are some questions to ask then. First of all, what's the motivation of the person? Do they have a motivation in trying to deceive you with the numbers? Are they trying to sell you something? So when you see a statistic, ask that question first of all. Ask yourself, what doesn't the number tell us? For example, the number of exam passes by students at a school isn't the same as the quality of education they've received. There are many other aspects to education besides number of exam passes. So what doesn't the number tell us? Is a number based on unrepresentative survey? Some tabloid newspapers get people to phone in with their views on a particular topic. Of course, those phoning in aren't necessarily representative of the population at large. Angry people tend to phone in more often than people who aren't angry, for example. Mm. Is the number based on a very small sample? Small samples are unreliable. If you only ask four people a question, you're likely to get extreme results, which are unrepresentative. If a questionnaire was used to obtain the number, was it biased? Did it involve leading questions? You know, you do think murderers should be hanged, don't you, for example? It pushes you towards a particular answer. Are comparisons valid? I mean, at the moment, with the COVID-19 syndrome, they're comparing death rates in different countries. But in Britain, they haven't been counting deaths in care homes and in the community, deaths at home and so on. So can you really compare the death rates of different countries? Total or per capita? COVID-19, we should surely be comparing the death rates, taking into account the population of countries. Bigger countries are likely to have bigger death rates. And ask yourself, finally, those are the main points in my book, does the number make sense? Does it really make sense? Use your common sense. If it doesn't, then have some doubts about it.
Do you trust any statistic you read now, Paul?
Oh, absolutely. I hope I haven't come across as being an anti-statistician. Numbers used correctly can inform our lives. They can help us to make better decisions. For example, many of us worry about risks, which are minimal. We tend to worry about the risk of terrorist attacks and so on. Yet the probability of being, if you look at the figures, the probability of being a victim of a terrorist attack is extraordinarily low. A lot of us worry about crime. when in fact the probability of being a victim of crime is also low. So statistics can often help us with our fears and tell us that those fears are groundless. So yes, I do trust statistics, but I always ask those sort of questions first before I do trust them.
Well, I hope our listeners are more skeptical of the numbers they hear, because we regularly question them on the program. But if you'd like to know more and sort of get your head around the things that are being used to get us to feel and act in different ways, these powerful numbers, the book is called Something Doesn't Add Up. The author is Paul Goodwin. Paul, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me on the show.